Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Stick around for a breakdown of the news of the day later in this episode. But first, in June of 1981, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released a report describing a deadly disease affecting five young, previously healthy gay men in Los Angeles. That disease was AIDS. And when you look back at the history of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, often the stories at the center are of men, leaving the women who have also been impacted by the illness out of the conversation. And despite all the advances in HIV research over the last 40 years, women, particularly women of color and young women, continue to be disproportionately affected. One online exhibition is flipping the script and centering the stories of women living with HIV and AIDS. It's called I'm Still Surviving. In this next conversation, we'll learn more about the project's impact and we'll get a firsthand account of a local woman living with HIV. At the table, Jennifer Breyer, Distinguished Professor of History and Gender and Women's Studies at UIC and founder of the I'm Still Surviving online exhibition. And Marta Santiago, a Chicagoan who participated in the exhibition. She was diagnosed with HIV in the late 80s. I started by asking Marta how she's doing these days. Here she is.
I'm getting older.
You're getting older. We all are.
Yes, we are. I just made 74, and I had no view of that when I first got diagnosed. But wow. Here I am, and we're talking.
Happy belated birthday.
Well, muchas gracias.
I want to sink more into that. 74, you said you never thought you would see that.
I didn't look that far ahead.
Yeah?
No.
So
no,
when the day arrived, tell me what was going through your mind.
When which day arrived? 74?
74, the big day.
I was like, what am I doing today? What do I need to get out of the way? I was looking at timelines of legal stuff, like my taxes I haven't done yet.
All regular, ordinary things.
Listen, all of the stuff that really gets me, I could get twisted in the head if I don't take care of things.
Yeah. Ordinary life was on your mind.
Ordinary life is right. Ordinary.
And thanks to the advancement of medicine and HIV diagnosis, it's not considered a death sentence anymore.
In my head, I'm looking at, even though they say that there are, not that they say there are absolutely people getting infected daily, but it's not like when we were diagnosed back in early 90s, it was like, 89, what am I talking about? Gee, time goes by. It was, well, what do we do here? What do we have in front of us? Mm. What do I have in front of me? I would say at least 95% of my energies towards my son because I found out he was positive. Mm. So I had my work set out for me. And yeah, that's all I looked at. But I saw a lot of people come into the program where I was at Cook County. And they...
You worked for a woman and children?
I was a patient first. Mm. And then I got
you worked
into
for a program.
Their program. I was working with the women and children's program. Mm. Right. But there were a lot of women that I saw did not make it, you know, and they were young. I couldn't get it. I couldn't understand. I says, what's the difference? We got the medications here, or what the little bit we had at the time, and why weren't they making it?
Jennifer, let's bring you in here. It's estimated 40 million people are living with HIV globally. Mm-hmm. Here in Illinois, that number is about 41,000. What should we know about the natural history of HIV in women as opposed to men?
Yeah, the first thing I think is important, what Marta just said, is that the Women and Children's AIDS program starts at Cook County, led by a doctor named Marge Cohen, and a range of other women, including Dr. Mildred Williamson. And they are forming a clinic and a care program at a moment when there is virtually no medication. So to sort of understand that, the biomedical part of this, mm-hmm. and that we now think of the fact that you can take antiretroviral drugs, like that is not in the mind of the people who have started this clinic.
So treatments have certainly evolved over time from nothing.
Right. But the other thing that's evolved is a real system of care that goes beyond something medical. And I think that that is fundamentally important. So the part of the natural history of HIV in relationship to women and in relationship to treatment is that women are the first people to be a patient body that is tested to figure out that treatment is a form of prevention. So the women that are in the Women and AIDS program that Marta was in, and women around the country, largely women of color, mm-hmm. mostly Black women, are part of trials that prove that it's possible to intervene in maternal to fetal transmission of HIV by taking a set of drugs. That becomes the basis on which every form of prevention that is medicalized, mm-hmm. what we now know as PrEP, that's the first PrEP trial.
Wow.
And so it's women's bodies on the line to figure that out. It's women who are part of the story that we don't hear about because we only focus on men. And what Marta didn't say, and what I'll say, is, of course, your open on the June 1981 cases, mm-hmm. Marta was infected with HIV when that article came out. And she wouldn't know that until 1989. But we also wouldn't know that by the way we talk about it anymore.
Right.
Like, Marta was living with HIV in her body at least as early as 1980. And it's not part of the way we tell the story.
Mm.
But she's living proof that we have to tell the story that way.
And you're telling the stories of women like Marta in I'm Still Surviving, in mm-hmm. your online exhibition. Tell me about the reasons why you centered women in this project.
Well, the project is really the women telling their stories. We met with a group of women at the Women's Interagency HIV Study, which is down the block from me at UIC on Harrison Street, not far from where Marta grew up. And that's this huge study of the natural history of HIV in women's bodies. And there were about, I don't know, 20 people around the table. It was the 20th anniversary of the program. It was in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And the women were really interested in talking about their lives as people living with HIV, as people in recovery, as people, as parents, as Chicagoans, lives that are totally determined by HIV and so much more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we allowed that to drive the conversation. And that was the first one. Then we went to Brooklyn, New York, and we went to Raleigh, Durham, and we talked to dozens more women. And so the exhibition really tries to weave those stories
yeah.
together.
Marta, how do you think this approach that Jennifer just laid out helped to shape the stigma around HIV?
She hit it right on the head, because that's what it was. It was what we as women coming to the program were bringing. We couldn't come to clinic because we had to be there for our kids coming out of school. We couldn't come because, well, we had jobs to keep a roof over our head to feed our kids. Those were some of the things that we were hearing from the women, and incorporating it into, okay, it's got to be in letter, program, clinic hours. We got to work around how the women want things. And once a lot of these things came out, then again, it shaped the program. But what I wanted to make a correction on was that at the beginning, the program was called the Women and Children's AIDS Project. Then I said, I don't have AIDS. Why is it an AIDS And then Marge said, okay, we're going to change it to the HIV. But it's not a project anymore. It's a program. We've already come, you know, into that arena. And
words matter.
I just want, yes.
Absolutely.
How did your family and friends react when you were first?
Oh, not everybody was letting on this. Oh, there was, okay, we had an actual, his school gave an emergency, let's say, parent and teacher meeting in the auditorium.
When they found out that there was a kid with HIV.
My fourth grader decided that he was so smart, he was going to raise his hand saying that he knows what viruses and bacteria are, but he knew that virus.
Yes.
And he says, I have one that can cause AIDS.
He says it out loud.
Yeah.
To the other students?
To the class. Yeah. Because the teacher was asking if they understood, you know, covering and coughing, what this and that are, you know, wash your hands, you know, being clean. And so when that came about, I said, this is why understanding we can't tell just everyone, because then some bozo decided to print out this letter and put it into the surrounding homes of the school in their mailboxes, that they should not let, who was this kid? Who planted him? Where did he come from? Our kids could get infected, and if you're smart, you'll take your kids out of this school. Things like that. So,
how did you?
That was a very scary situation, because I used to have in my head, oh, somebody's going to find out, and then we're going to wake up one day, and AIDS is going to be all over
our
building. But they took care of it in the sense that they got health educators. I even offered our people at from Cook County, from the program.
Right.
But they got health educators and doctors to come and explain, you know, that this isn't something that, you know, is flying through the air.
Tell me more about some of the myths that you've had to, over the years, dispel about HIV and AIDS. Like, are there some things that people came up to you?
That one in particular, you know, that you're next to somebody and it's going to jump on you. You know, I used to hear stories about people getting... That somebody was found in their family to have HIV or AIDS, and they'd put them in a corner with paper plates and plastic
utensils,
spoons and forks. Yeah, they had to have their own and away from everybody. So it wasn't nice. I mean, there was so many people that went, and but the stories, they were treated like scum. You know, and a lot, like my son, he had nothing to do with it. Mom just happened to have it and passed it on to him.
Right.
And we didn't know until I went, he was almost eight when we found out. But he took it well. How am I going to tell him? He was used to being in the clinic, playing around with the kids.
Mm-hmm. Before we continue talking about the project, Jennifer, I wanted to share new reporting out from our Sun-Times colleague, Elvia Malagon. HIV and AIDS infections have gone up in Chicago after years of decline. There's been a particular increase among Chicago's Latino population. Let me hear from both of you. What goes through your mind when you hear me say a statistic like that? You first, Jennifer.
I heard the report. It's pretty devastating. I'd say that the backsliding that we've seen both from the COVID-19 pandemic and from the attacks on science and medicine and ethnic studies and gender studies, mm-hmm. all of the things in the university, but also in science, attacks on science. You sort of can understand that is a natural consequence of these things. At the same time that I think we are at a moment where the sort of geopolitical forces are such that, and this was true when Marta was infected in 1980, these things have not changed. We do have a set of medical solutions, but we have never, actually implemented the wide-ranging sort of larger structural solutions that we need to make people healthy. But you think about something like the Ryan White Care Act of 1990, which basically is the mechanism by which most people without insurance or who are on Medicare or Medicaid access treatment. The kinds of ways that we keep treatment from people, the ways that we keep healthcare from people, the ways that we are structured make it virtually impossible to imagine another outcome at this point.
That project of yours, Jennifer, the exhibition, it includes four parts where you can see, you can hear, you can read, and you can teach. Mm-hmm. Tell us more.
Well, we wanted to really feature the women's voices. And so my favorite section is the hear section, where you can listen. You can hear women engaged in conversation with one another, and the way the exhibition is structured, you can basically imagine the dialogue. So just to set the stage, for many of the women, they were interviewed by other women living with HIV. Some were not, but many were. And so you can hear that interplay. We added the teach section more recently, actually, and it was a place where I had a pair of graduate students working with me at UIC who really led that effort to think about how we need to be teaching HIV in the age of COVID, right? So we think that we call that the pandemic. And of course, AIDS is a pandemic. So we've always been living in pandemic times.
I feel like we transpose those words, pandemic, epidemic.
Yeah.
I've heard it called both.
Right. And then there's this other word called a syndemic, which is the synthesis of things. You know, scientists are funny people.
But, thank you, professor.
Yes, thank you. But the teach section is really important, and it goes back to Marta's earlier point, which was that we wanted to design something that would allow particularly high school teachers and college instructors to have access to a way to teach the women's history of HIV, because we believe that understanding the women's history of HIV is a way to understand how we are where we are. The teach section has one that focuses on oral histories, which is what I'm trained in and what Marta participated in. And then there's a section that allows for a more art-based curriculum for students to make zines and think about the relationship between reproductive justice and HIV.
So leave us with this. And again, I want to hear from you both. What do you want our listeners to understand right now about what living with HIV looks like for women? Let's focus on women. For women here, locally, what does that look like today? What should they know, Marta?
Oh, gosh. My granddaughter is coming into my head right now.
Tell me why.
She's going to be 16. So much I would like for her to know. And this is one part she doesn't yet. My son has not evaded so much as, well, if you want to tell her, tell her. So I have been given the right of way.
So your 16-year-old granddaughter does not know that her father is HIV positive.
Right.
Does she know about you?
No.
So she doesn't know about any of the family history?
No. So I'm wheeling in on telling her this summer when she's here.
Wow.
So of age. And again, I'm focusing on, she's going to be in that active, if I hope not already. But again, she's a young woman, and there's things that I've been wanting to tell her and talk to her about, and at the same time, I feel like I'm overstepping. But then at the same time, this might be the summer. But I it's never going to go away. I don't think in my lifetime. Even though there is a talk of cure and they're doing some research and looking into that, will it be in my lifetime? I don't know. But you know, again, those few things of education, And this isn't the only thing we've got to worry about as far as what one can acquire.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Jennifer.
Listening to Marta say those words, there's something really incredible about being able to learn from people who have been living with HIV for 40 years. That is really just incredible to think about how you navigate those things. I think it's important to recognize that there are many, many, many people living, thousands and thousands of Illinoisans living with HIV, and there are hundreds of thousands more who are not, who have passed. And even if we could stop new infections, right, AIDS is not going to be over. It's not over because we have people living with it and it's part of our lives. It's stitched into the fabric of everything around us. And I think it's really important for us to understand that, as I say in the exhibition, and I've said in lots of different contexts on this show and otherwise, when you put women at the center of history, it confirms everything that you know and it changes everything that you know at the same time.
Yeah.
And so to be able to hear from Marta today and her thinking about what it means to tell her 16-year-old granddaughter.
In real time.
In real time is quite an incredible thing to think about. In terms of all of the reality is that all of us are living with HIV. Some of us are living with it in our bodies, and some of us are living with it in our worlds. But we are all responsible for thinking about what that means.
That's such a great way to put it. Jennifer Breyer is Distinguished Professor of History and Gender and Women's Studies at UIC and founder of I'm Still Surviving, an online exhibition that's a living women's history of HIV and AIDS. And Marta Santiago is a Chicagoan living with HIV, and she participated in that exhibition. If you want to check it out, folks, it's online at stillsurviving.net. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise.
Now we'll turn to the top stories of the day with WBEZ Morning Edition anchor Claire Lane, Miriam Kramer, WBEZ audio and digital editor, and Tracy Bain, executive director of the group Press Forward Chicago. That's a national network that aims to strengthen local news. Local housing advocates are suing the Chicago Housing Authority over the appointment of Keith Pettigrew as CEO. So that's where we started. Here's Claire with the details.
Pettigrew was the former housing director for the authority in Washington, D.C., and people are upset, groups in that various communities, because they say that they weren't consulted at all. They didn't get to weigh in on this appointment, that the vote was essentially illegal. So people, in some cases that WBEZ spoke to, didn't even know who the guy is.
Oh, wow.
And they want, essentially, for this vote to be overturned. They want a new vote.
Makes you wonder how that even happens, right? How do you get in the CEO position and people aren't aware?
Right, exactly. So hence why they're upset.
Yeah. More housing news, Claire. Recent reporting from our own Adriana Cardona-Magigad and Esther Yunji Kang about migrants living here in Chicago and a new law that's making it harder for them to actually find safe and affordable housing.
So this is a very personal story. Esther and Adriana followed one family. I'd encourage you to listen to it at WBEZ.org. But as of January 1st, Illinois law now allows police to remove squatters, essentially viewing them as trespassers. So this simplifies the eviction process. Squatting is illegal, but this new law is essentially curbing those legal delays, just expediting this. Mm-hmm. So if police say have probable cause, they believe that maybe a crime of criminal trespass was taking place, like the property was broken into or something like that, they can just walk in and then you don't have any rights as a tenant. So Esther and Adriana talked to one migrant family living in a situation where there wasn't a paper trail. You know, a lot of their rent money was being paid in cash, no background checks, no lease, you know what I mean? Anything like that. So they didn't have a lot of support regarding any rights as tenants, and essentially they were evicted. So this is causing headaches for a lot of people who are in similar situations.
Again, that's up at WBEZ.org. Great reporting by our race, class, and communities desk there. In other news, Miriam, a 300-million-year-old fossil that was found in Illinois back in the year 2000. It's back in the news. Why?
It is. Okay, so scientists reanalyzed this fossil. They took it back into the lab. They did some more scans to sort of learn a little more about it, because it was always sort of weird. Like, there weren't a lot of octopuses around at this time. Oh. So they took it back in the lab. They scanned, and they figured out that it actually has little teeth, which is very weird for octopuses.
Oh my goodness.
And they've actually reclassified it as a nautilus relative, which are these like kind of bizarre looking shelled creatures that have a bunch of tentacles and teeth and stuff. Look them up. They're weird. but it is now a nautilus relative and not an octopus relative. So it has been taken out of the Guinness Book of World Records, unfortunately, for the fossil.
Too many teeth.
It gets us all.
It's now disqualified.
Exactly.
Tracy, Chicago recently lost a pioneering conservationist and LGBTQ activist. I'm talking about Nan Schaefer. Can you tell us a bit about who she was and the impact that she had on our city?
Yeah, Nan moved here from the Bronx Zoo in the early 1980s, and she immediately started getting involved in women's soccer and women's music, but also the LGBTQ community with organizations such as Impact and later Equality Illinois, Lambda Legal. I met her on the soccer fields, and she became my biggest supporter in starting Outlines newspaper, which later purchased Windy City Times. So she was one of the really big supporters of LGBTQ media in Chicago. Mm. But her most important impact is internationally. She pioneered reproductive technology techniques, in particular in the Sumatran rhino, but it had an effect on the breeding for other rhinos around the world. Some of the Sumatran babies that have been born in Indonesia directly are connected to the work she did over decades with her nonprofit called SOS Rhino. So she passed away a couple weeks ago. Her wife, Karen Dixon, is working on how to pay tribute and such. But her impact was also national in terms of Lambda Legal. They put $1 million into the Emmett Till monuments. They put $1 million into marriage equality work through Lambda Legal. So a really great loss. Finally, I'd say that luckily during her lifetime, Brookfield Zoo last fall did their most prestigious honor, the George Rabb Award, for her, and she was able to receive that in person. Jeff Corwin presented it, so I'm really glad that she was acknowledged in her lifetime. Field.
Yeah, what a loss, Tracy. And I know that you posted on social media just, you know, how much she meant to you, right? She had a really incredible personal impact on your own life.
I do not think I would have the career I have without her. Other than my mother, I don't think there's anybody that impacted me more. She was a little bit Babe Diedrichson and Amelia Earhart rolled into one. It's hard to think of her not being around. She was such an incredible athlete and just human being. But I really, truly don't think I'd have my career in the gay press and all the other things that came out of that without her. And it's one of those people that, you know, behind the scenes influences your life in such profound ways. I actually did write a book about her with her before she passed, but I'm not sure if it'll end up coming out now that she has passed, but it was wonderful being able to explore her life. In particular, she was the third generation from J.C. Hall, the founder of Hallmark. And she really did honor the too much is given, much will be required. And that's what I really learned most from her, is that she was very unassuming, especially about her wealth, and spread it to the people that needed it. Whether that was the Till Monument or Lambda Legal, right? And so I really respect everything she did for our communities and others.
Let's pivot to some space news. I'm looking at you, Miriam, because we got to talk Artemis II. You are kind of our resident, one of our resident space nerds here. Where are the astronauts now? What's going on?
Yeah, so they are on their way back. So they've done their flyby of the moon. They're heading back to Earth. They're planning on landing tomorrow off the coast of California in the Pacific Ocean. And and then the mission's going to come to a close. It's been a kind of wild week.
It's insane to hear you say it's coming to a close. It's just there's just been such an episode after episode after episode. Clara, you're following it, right?
Yeah, it's been very exciting for many people. NPR had actually an interesting segment on Morning Edition talking about most people have been following this very excited, except for the president, who has sort of had a lackluster reaction to this.
I'm not surprised.
And some of the criticism of that is that it's just really not part of his brand.
Oh, okay.
Part of his messaging.
Mm-hmm. So, Miriam, I mean, did Artemis II really tell us anything new? Like, remind us of the mission here. And I want to know from you, was this a success?
Yeah. So it was a test flight. And in that way, it was, I would say, a big success so far. There's still one sort of big test coming up, which is reentry. We got to see how their capsule's heat shield does. That's going to be the next sort of like nail-biting moment for everybody. And that happens tomorrow. But yeah, I think overall, like, it seems as if the aside from the toilet, the spacecraft
the
has
toilet
done
issue.
Really well.
Yes.
And
I love that one.
I know.
That
was
a great one. Personal
they
chuckle.
They have gone further than any previous mission. So
they
it's
have.
A success on that front.
It's a huge success there. And I mean, they're happy in space. Like, they're doing the thing.
And Miriam, to Claire's earlier point, the Trump administration, they cut funding for the sciences, right? So not only was the president, you know, not impressed, but they cut funding for the sciences overall. I wonder if you think this success of the mission could put pressure on them to, you know, change course there.
There's a part of me that wants to say, like, yes, perhaps. But I will say last week, the Trump administration did announce more cuts for NASA.
All right.
So even as this mission was launching, as people were paying a lot of attention to it, you know, major cuts there potentially in the future still. So it's complicated. I mean, this mission was, you know, happening during Trump's first term in the White House, too. He was supportive of it then. And now it seems like maybe the winds have shifted a little bit.
Interesting. What other stories are you following, Claire?
We are following another kind of neat art fair that's popping up tonight through the weekend. It's the Other Art Fair, lasting through Sunday over at Artifact Events in Ravenswood. All kinds of art and mediums, paintings, some photography, sculpture. But what's interesting about this is that most, if not all, of the artists are there physically, so art seekers can engage with them directly. You can ask them questions. I've gone the last few years just personally, and it is kind of fun. You just get to sort of poke and prod people and find out what inspires them. This year's theme is nostalgia.
Oh, cool. Nice. Tracy, this daily panel, for folks especially who tune into In the Loop, they'll know that this is usually just folks from inside our own newsroom. But to celebrate Local News Day, which is today, we felt the need to loop you in as part of the conversation. You are someone who's been such a pillar of local news here in Chicago for a very long time. So how are you and Press Forward celebrating today?
Yeah, my whole life has been local news, and I've seen how it affects people on a day-to-day basis. You talked about HIV/AIDS earlier, the vital role that local media played in educating people about actions and protests and drug experiments, and et cetera. So for me at Press Forward Chicago and all 44 Press Forwards around the country, we're really promoting folks just doing something to support local media. It could mean signing up for a free newsletter. Whatever it is, whoever you read, from sometimes to Block Club to the Tribe to whatever publications you read locally, they are vital to the fabric of Chicago.
Yes.
And we just urge folks to read, sign up, and support if you can.
We put so much emphasis into getting out into the communities and doing great reporting there. We've got a great spread, actually, on if you've got the paper version of the Sun-Times today, I encourage folks to take a look at that. But why is local news important to you?
Oh, it's so important to me. I mean, so I spent most of my career as a national reporter on the Space Beat. And then a few years ago, I switched over to local news at the public radio station in Nashville. Shout out WPLN.
Yes.
While I loved my work as a national reporter, like being covering the community that I live in is so incredibly powerful.
Yes.
Like being a person who is affected by the news and also covering it, like you have an entirely new perspective. And so I think it's like, truthfully, nothing is more important in the news ecosystem than local news.
Right. Tracy Baim is executive director of the group Press Board Chicago, and WBEZ's Claire Lane and Miriam Kramer.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Micah Yasin, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. If you like what you heard, we hope you'll join us for more. We drop a new episode about Chicago news and culture every weekday afternoon, including our weekly news recap on Fridays, and once a month, Ask the Mayor. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.